Welcome to Still Entitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Norm.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Jeremy.
Jeremy Williams.
Norm, I really appreciate your attempting to add some heavy modulation to your voice for the welcome. I feel like we could, next time we have Roman Mars on, we could do a little Roman gives Adam and Norm some instruction in a radio voice.
But yeah. He doesn't need to do it. He just does. That's his natural speaking voice.
I'm not positive about
that. I've hung out with him off camera.
Really? And yeah, I mean, I have hung out, but not enough to analyze his voice. But don't you think he pours the sugar on just a little bit more for the...
One should.
Maybe for intros?
Yeah.
For when you have the very definitive thing.
My wife makes fun of me for having a phone voice. She says, hey kids, that's his phone voice.
It's maybe the same thing.
My friends call mine the actually voice. They're like, oh, he's making the actually voice, which is good to have friends that will point that out.
Well, you can never hear, I never know what I sound like anyway.
When
you turn on your radio voice, or whatever we'll call it, do you know what that sounds like?
Yes. No, I totally, I could tell what it feels like coming out of me.
I can sense
when the mansplaining is rising in me and coming out.
We could attune
a chip to a pitch in your voice, and the collar lights up blue and says, don't listen to anything I'm saying. I'm just a self-important schmuck.
Or the EEG that tells you you're picking that part of your brain that actually isn't recalling memory. It's just making it up as you go along.
Yes. Yeah.
No, I mean, look, it. I'm a veteran mansplainer. I'm working on it. It often eclipses the very thing I'm trying to say.
Very nice.
Thank you.
You know, yesterday, as we're recording this, we were out in outside the cave, actually, just standing on the street looking up at the sky at around 10:15 a.m.
Yes. I was up on my roof with Thing 1 and Thing 2 here in the mission.
And then you came rolling by on a one wheel with three welding masks and threw them at us.
You were looking at the sky with your naked eyes.
They had glasses.
Yeah. Ah,
they weren't Donald Trumping it.
That's what I wondered. It sounded like.
No.
No, but I my sons and I watched a bunch of the eclipse from the roof of my house. And I actually took a selfie with them.
Nice.
And we tweeted it wearing the welding masks.
Nice.
And then I rode back to the shop with all the welding helmets. And lo, as I pull up on the one wheel, the whole tested crew is out front looking at the thing, so I handed out welding helmets, and Danica said, that is maybe the most Adam Savage moment I've ever experienced.
Yeah, sounds about right. So does a welding helmet look the same as the glasses that you got?
It was you get better field of view.
Right.
I thought.
You get a much better field of view. So the welding helmets I have are all auto-darkening, and if we had done this before the podcast, before the eclipse, I would have explained this. It's really important to set them to the highest possible setting, which is 13 or 14.
Yes, and 12 plus is what you need.
12 plus, and that's sufficient. In fact, a 13, which one of my helmets goes to, is just a little bit, not quite enough when there's no cloud in front. But luckily in San Francisco, classically, we had clouds in front of our eclipse.
I love that all the stories were on don't look at the sun, and you should never look at the sun on a normal day. It's not just the sun isn't extra bright on the eclipse day.
Yeah.
It's just when everyone
The problem is, I feel like, is that it's always trying to do this end run around the but, and the but is, but the sun is covered by the moon, so isn't that safe? Yes, for the, 10 seconds that you're only witnessing the corona, but for every other instance before and after that, you're in danger.
And that's only in the path of totality.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you're anywhere outside of that path, then... You know, you're still seeing a significant portion of the sun. I think here in San Francisco, it was at most 75% or so, 70-80%.
75% occlusion.
Yeah. And which looked fantastic.
Yeah, it was really nifty and weird.
It got a little bit dark. I mean, it wasn't, uneventful.
It got crepuscular.
Right.
To use the...
And I think the best... people were tweeting their photos, but the best thing, even if you didn't have the glasses, it was cool just to walk down the street and see... You can see who was picking out, if you were wearing the glasses, of course you're looking up. A lot of people were holding out their colanders.
Mm-hmm.
They were looking at shadows from trees and leaves.
Oh, yeah, they were doing pinhole cameras.
Yeah.
And
it was really cool just as around 9:30, 9 to 10, just to watch people on the street, everyone kind of do their thing and observe it their own way.
From my roof, looking around my particular block in the mission, it was fun because there was like four or five people dotted around the roofs of the buildings all doing it. Someone tweeted a photo of them and their kids, which was hilarious because they'd all made these oblong camera obscuras out of cardboard. And so it was like these three children all with giant long cardboard boxes on their heads trying to variously aim at this particular location. It was very entertaining.
It was amazing. I think NASA at some point had six different live streams all about the eclipse. They had activated all their social media and all their YouTube channels. It was really cool.
It was thrilling to have something that was not politics that involved everyone, that was just about shit that was happening. That was delightful news cycle.
No, and a great way to, you know, everyone, a shared experience for everyone in North America. Do you know people who went up to Path of Totality?
I do. I have actually good friends that that months ago planned a long weekend to Nashville, which was in the Path of the Totality, and enjoyed it immensely. My relatives up in Oregon were inviting me. I just couldn't take the time, unfortunately.
Mm. Yeah, lots of, I think, yeah, people made up their made the way up to the Oregon coast.
Did you see the traffic map?
That's the thing.
No thank you.
Once you were there, getting back out of there, it was madness. Unless you had made a big trip out of it and stayed overnight afterward. And then the next eclipse, I think, over North America.
2024?
Yeah, and then 2045, I want to say.
I think there's two right away.
Really?
In 10 years, I think there's two right, like 1 year after another.
I didn't realize the culture of eclipse chasing was so obsessive.
Well, so when you read, I was telling my wife about this on the phone last night. There's a great book called Longitude about the attempt to solve the problem of longitude that finishes with the invention of one of the most accurate clocks up until that point ever designed. Mm-hmm. Using bimetallic springs and all these ways to offset the movement of a ship. But longitude includes all these astronomical observational stories as people were trying to figure out, is there a way to sight my longitude just from looking at the sky? And so astronomers would venture out from England was one of the primary exporters of astronomers to go take astronomical readings of occlusions of different planets at different times from different parts of the world to see what they could learn. And all of these stories are rife with people who spent their entire lives taking boats for years and decades to locations only to have a cloudy day.
Right.
Oh, that's like, you'd have these like
expensive trips to Tasmania and Indonesia.
Darkest African of, oh, it's raining. All right.
That's
life. Guess you've got to pack up and go.
That's why the new bucket list item is the chartered flight. I think Alaska Airlines did one for this eclipse.
Really?
And it was piggybacking on the story in 2016 when I think it was an astronomer from the Hayden Planetarium had figured out that one of the flights from to Honolulu would cross in totality. And convince Alaska Airlines to delay their flight by half an hour.
Wow.
So that everyone on the flight could see totality come.
That's
and then there's
genius.
A great YouTube video that Alaska Airlines put out.
Imagine if you're sitting one away from the window and in the window is some like bratty kid who's like covered in Cheeto dust and
looking
milk
at his iPhone.
And just like looking at his iPhone.
And then once word got out about that flight, it was booked up immediately, but there were already people on that plane who had just booked the flight the flight and they got a special treat.
So this wasn't a flight that was launched for the eclipse.
Like in 2016.
That would
be
interesting. Why wouldn't they do that?
They did one for this year.
Okay.
Yeah, they did one for this year, and I think they'll probably do one.
Like take off and land from the same airport?
I don't know exactly what it was, but I mean, it's regulation wise, it's complicated.
Yeah, good point.
So in addition to this, totally separate, I've been doing some fairly involved machining in my shop.
Yeah. I mean, I almost don't believe you. That looks so store-bought. It's unbelievable.
A couple weeks ago, I tweeted some photos of a handmade compass I made because I've been sort of obsessed with these NASA parts. These are for my A7L suit that Ryan Nagata built. I wanted to make all aluminum hardware for it. And I decided to dive in, and I used that compass and did a bunch of drawings at home. And this is all part of sort of getting rid of my fear of the mill, because about a year and a half ago, I did some machining on there for some spacesuit parts that I kept on screwing up.
Yep.
And machining is like any other skill that you have. You have to keep it up, right? I hadn't picked up the instrument of a milling machine in a long time. And this was my return to form of really carefully pre-planning the order of operations, how I was going. Because with something like this, I had to actually machine two different fixtures for holding it after the primary machining processes in order to be able to add the multiple grooves and slots and pieces and then be able to realign them.
Are those two solid pieces right there?
These are two solid pieces. Here you go.
You find more satisfaction in the problem-solving process to figure out that order of operations, or would you, if you were able to CAM that up and then have that CAD CAM pipeline automate that for a machine, would that be your path of least resistance? Or
I certainly have enough people with CNC machines where it would not be very difficult for me to take a detailed drawing and have this done. That is totally something I can do, but I'm not that interested in doing it. I do find the process of machining, I made six of these. Mm-hmm. It was exhausting. It was about 15 hours of work. It's super tedious, super precise work where every step of the way you have to double check all your shit. And it's tiring. It's literally like a workout. And when I'm done and I look at them, I'm like, damn, that was cool. But being in the middle of it, it's not fun. It's just deeply satisfying. There's a way in which the lack of fun, you know,
like any workout.
When you get into that tedium and you like you've given yourself over to it, like I am now going to do what it takes to finish this fucking thing.
Right. Well, you get in far enough for yourself to get hooked.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the beginning, it's a blank slate, and it's completely frustrating. But once you're hooked by the project, I imagine you can't stop.
And I started by making – I always make too many because there's always something that gets screwed up. So I started making – I needed five total. I made seven blanks. I totally screwed up one, like a complete failure of one. And I made one extra that's just for me off the suit.
Given your excellent point about automation, I'm wondering, is doing this by hand a dying art, given as prevalent as, you know, CNC mills and computer-controlled machines are becoming?
That's a good question. It could be. Here's the reason I don't think it will be a dying art. Look, it certainly could be, but I don't think so. And one of the reasons is because Bridgeport milling machines are so freaking durable. Like the Bridgeport and the import type machines that are based off the Bridgeport model, there's hundreds of thousands of them, if not millions, in the U.S. The ones that I have were made in 1968. They're still fantastic and in great working order. They're like, I don't know if you've ever had an old Singer sewing machine, like a treadle based sewing machine, but my grandmother had one. And when my mom went to sell it, they were like, yeah, it's worth like $200. And she's like, really? It's original, $18.99. And they're like, yeah, they're all still around.
Wow.
Like these were so solidly built. There's no market for them because they're all still working.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's enough. I don't know. I have this hope that there's enough people like me who like, I like to problem solve on the fly on the milling machine. And I do that all the time. I make tool holders. I do stuff where I'm not measuring and I'm just machining by feel. And there's a way in which that I really appreciate that process.
And for something like this, you didn't make a test piece first, did you? Like you didn't take a piece of Delrin and mill out.
No.
It went straight to the metal.
Well, I went straight to the metal, but you can see in the tweet, I tweeted this one photo. I'm not actually sure if I included you, but I actually wrote out the whole order of operations.
Right,
okay, the first thing I do is turn this, then I bevel it, then I'm going to chuck it back in the other way, then I need to make a tool holder for it, then I need to put it into the indexing head, then I need to make sure the indexing, where I screwed up is I had my indexing head set up to do these circular cuts. And once I had those at the correct degrees, then it was time to put these slots in. And on the first set of slots, my indexing head was perfectly aligned upright. But when I brought it to 90 degrees, it was off by about 3/4 of an inch. And I can see it in the slots. And I have to repair that on all six of these.
Well, it's because you batch made them too.
I set them up so each operation was done to each of the six.
So it really didn't make sense to just make the one Delrin one when you can make 6 or 10 all at once.
Plus, by the way, there's two different kinds of – actually, there's three different kinds of these.
Oh, so you had adjustments throughout.
There's a water connector, and that has a certain topography. Then there is the gas connectors, and the gas connectors are actually chiral. there's left-hand ones and right-hand ones, and so I had to keep track of all of, yeah, I'm getting chills just as, but it was deeply satisfying, and I'm about to send these out to have them anodized.
I mean, the drawings that you made, it makes me think of, like, programming almost. Like, you remember, like, those drawing programs, like, drawing the, what was that, the one that kids used back in the 90s, where you, like, you use a turtle and you program all your steps in and it draws a house or something.
Okay.
It's like that. Like, you write out all your steps and then you execute.
Do you do planning in longhand on big projects? Do you sit down and sketch, or what's your methodology?
Only when I'm writing. Like, if I'm writing, I mm-hmm. need to do an outline. There's no way I can finish a project unless there's an outline in front of me.
And do you do an outline in longhand or in the computer?
No, never. I haven't. That's a good question. No, I use my Notes app now, and that's about it. And when programming, it's all done on the keyboard as well. I know you're almost an artist with your writing.
I plotted all the MythBusters episodes on a whiteboard, and I have to plot as I'm EPing a show for a friend of ours. I had to write the plot out in longhand on paper just because that's how I'm paced to mm-hmm. think about a script.
Like Eminem.
That is the only time I will ever be compared to a genius of the level of. There's that Apple TV, there's the Apple documentary about Jimmy Iovine and Eminem and Dre.
HBO.
The Defiant Ones. Yeah, it's excellent.
And there's a sequence in there that they released early of Eminem and Dre and Iovine talking about their first meeting. And they have footage of Eminem freestyling in Dre's studio.
Yeah.
That's electric.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just never. It's so exciting seeing how both impressed Eminem is by what's going on, and yet that's not affecting his ability in any way to just bring it.
It just turns him on.
Right.
Yeah.
Super amazing.
Yeah, I enjoyed that whole documentary series. That was good.
I mean, I would never want to be at the other side of a negotiating table with Jimmy Iovine.
No.
Iovine? I mean. I would not want to be that person.
I didn't know anything about him until that documentary, besides the fact that he was, you know, bought from Beats to become Apple Music. But it makes me wonder, having watched that, should he not follow Tim Cook as the leader of Apple? The guy's vicious.
I'll tell you, not only is he vicious, but, like, when you read the whole story about how Monster Cable, one of the companies I think the least of in terms of their litigious, dumb nature of suing everyone who puts Monster in their thing, including suing Pixar for Monsters, Inc.
That's kidding. Crazy. These are the people who sell the gold-plated $50 audio home AV cables.
That's our word.
Yeah. So, and they sell vaporware. And they sell, like, oh, it's gold, whatever, plated stereo cables and all that bullshit. And yet, if you read the story about how Beats got taken to school by Iovine, you are like, Iovine's negotiating tactics makes Beats the underdog. Sorry, makes Monster Cable the underdog in the story. You feel sorry for them.
Yeah, go happened on a CES.
Which is amazing.
Like, for 10 years, and when you went, like, Beats, which now Apple owns, was a Monster Cable product, mm-hmm. and seeing the booth change from Monster to Beats to now, you know, that small, now it's part of Apple. It's crazy.
I can't remember who wrote the long, there's a long
there
form
is,
story.
A couple of years ago, I think Gizmodo had it.
It's really wonderful article, and it's heartbreaking. I mean, it shows you how far into the weeds you can get when you think you're making a deal, and you just have to, like, you get into bed with sharks like that, and you're gonna get bit.
Yes, but you think spatially and you draw stuff.
I think spatially and I draw stuff. Wait, what was I going to say? Oh, I wanted to mention some television. I watched the pilot, or the first episode. I guess you can't call them pilots anymore when they release a whole bunch at once.
I mean, the pilot really is actually, it's the test episode. Sometimes the pilot isn't even the first episode.
So for a Netflix original series where they dump it all at once, there's not really a pilot.
There isn't.
They shoot them all at once. I watched Ozark, the first episode of Ozark.
I've heard good things about this.
Jason Bateman,
right.
Laura Linney, about a money launderer in the Midwest.
Netflix is Breaking Bad.
Yeah, yes, so clearly that it's almost a little annoying. Bateman's amazing. Bateman is the reason to watch it. He's phenomenal. He directed this episode.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So he's invested in this. Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's wonderfully directed. The script is a little all over the place. I ended the first episode not being sure who to care about, but we're going to give it another few episodes because I tend to stop on the first episode if I'm not immediately drawn in, and I'm missing apparently some good stuff.
I hear it's very good. It's, there's so much on Netflix right now that it's just on the list.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like literally.
Yeah. Oh, no, totally. Yeah. Add to my list. Did you guys see the trailer for the Bryan Cranston produced Philip K. Dick sci-fi anthology series?
Oh, called Electric Sheep?
I think Electric Sleep.
Electric Sleep. Nice little illusion there that they did to get. Yeah. No, I have not seen the trailer for that.
It looks good. And I think this resurgence, I mean, there's Black Mirror, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But this resurgence of anthology series, anthology sci-fi,
which is super exciting because I grew up on The Twilight Zone and Tales of Ordinary Madness,
Outer Limits,
and it's really exciting that this is happening. If you want to feel better about the world, if you need that as a pill just to take, you should watch a trailer for a film called Patty Cakes.
Okay.
Oh. And the S on Patty Cakes is a dollar sign, and it's about a young woman who wants to be a rapper, and it's
a young obese white
woman who wants to be a rapper, and the actress they cast is so electrically invigoratingly exciting to watch, and it looks like kind of an amazing film. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Thing Two and I watched Apocalypse Now last night
for the first time for him.
Wow. And you know, probably the 10th time for me.
Yeah.
That shot of Martin Sheen coming out of the water is literally, I can tell you, it's the shot that made me fall in love with film as an art form at 17. I was like, oh, what is happening?
For me, that was Dream a Little Dream, a Corey Haim, Corey Feldman flick.
Two Coreys!
You know, it's whatever you watch at that age.
Wow!
Yeah, they just had artsy scenes in that film. You know, when they did the redux of Apocalypse Now, I thought, how in the world can they make an old film look this good? But the smoke that they... The color of the smoke that they made from... I don't know how they could recreate that from the negatives, but wow, does that film look good now.
The new master is... We watched not the redux, but the color of what we were watching was incredible.
Okay.
And, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about Zack Snyder watching this because there was a terrific article. We talked about it on the podcast about how Zack Snyder seems to be moving as a director... always towards building a moment, like Superman with his cape flowing while the people are below with a dramatic sky behind him.
Yep.
But he doesn't actually do a lot of the dramatic work to get you to those moments.
Mm.
He just builds them. Apocalypse Now is this object lesson in both the drama being worthy of the imagery and the imagery being worthy of the genre, of the drama. Because every single shot in that movie is a painting.
You know, I'm trying to think of films that do the other thing where they earn so much of it and the payoff is just missing the flourish. Oh.
See, because there's another I thought you were going to bring up that earn it and pay it off with very little fanfare, which is actually, I think, almost Mike Lee's entire career. Mike Lee, the filmmaker who did Topsy Turvy and Naked and Abigail's Wedding, Grown Ups. Oh, he's a working class British filmmaker who specialized for the longest time in just like working class Brits living their little lives. But every single one of these films is this tiny, amazing, polished gem of dramatic storytelling and a little bit of a triumph towards the end where it's just like someone's like, oh, this is nice. And like that's the crescendo dramatically. And you're moved by it.
That feels like the Woody Allen to me. Like the end of Manhattan or something.
But, you know. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. In those days, there was those like really beautiful, subtle payoffs. Like the beautiful payoff of Woody Allen and Diane Weiss being together at the end of Hannah and Her Sisters.
Mm.
You know, you don't expect.
Yeah.
Little contemplative moment
yes,
there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, speaking of reissues, is there a new Blade Runner reissue coming out? I saw...
You mean of the original movie?
Yes, original. I want to say there is a 4K... There is a 4K screening of it soon in San Francisco. I don't know if this is a new 4K remaster.
Fascinating.
I thought it was. And I thought it was nationwide.
Yeah.
For a week.
Yes.
It would be very smart for them to do that.
Yeah.
I mean... There's a movie that is totally worth going to see in the theater as often as you can find
it
in the theater.
I've never seen it in the theater.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially watching it. So I've seen it. I've actually seen of the various cuts, I've seen one, two, three. I've seen four of the original cuts as they were released in the theater. Those famous compromise cut in the early 90s that was released here in the city in L.A., I saw that. The first director's cut and then the final director's cut.
There was back in the, it's over 10 years ago, they had that briefcase five-disc set.
I still have that. Yeah. I've got some pieces of it on some of the cabinet shelves here.
I got that in HD DVD.
Yep.
A format that I cannot play anymore.
Oh,
on
really?
Any of the devices.
Was that played on like Xbox or something?
I played on an Xbox accessory.
Yeah, the accessory disc. Yeah. No.
No, I chose the wrong format.
So Superdrive won't play that?
Actually, I don't know.
Maybe.
No, I don't think so.
I think
no.
You need a special player.
No. Yeah.
So what version is being re-released?
It would be Ridley Scott's final cut.
The final cut.
The thing I was most surprised about watching that final cut, because I watched the original with Harrison Ford's stilted narration at least 10 times in theaters in New York in the 80s and the 90s, is when someone's not talking at you, how much more you see.
Mm.
Like, I'd seen this movie so many times, and yet without the narration while he's flying to the police station with Gaff, I'm like seeing things I have never seen before because there's been some neurological studies to show that when we're hearing words, our visual centers are diminishing in order to concentrate on the other information.
That's counterintuitive because it's more information. You should be seeing everything and hearing more.
It's like Brian Cox's character in Adaptation when he's like, don't you dare go to narration. It's the cheapest thing.
He says in a movie that is narrated.
And then it jumps him, cut immediately Charlie Kaufman / Nicolas Cage's
and
voice.
God help you if you now put narration in your film.
Exactly.
Yes, he's playing a screenplay, the famous Robert McKee. Oh, so Robert McKee is the father of the modern screenplay. He holds these classes and has written these seminal books on screenplay structure and writing. I have several friends who have taken his course and swear by it as a how to write a screenplay. But Adaptation is a wonderful meta-analysis of that, while it breaks all the rules that he says are steadfast and should be followed.
Yeah. Speaking of Blade Runner, one quick shout-out also. There's a Kickstarter going on right now for a short film inspired by the Blade Runner universe.
Those guys are amazing!
Luca, one of the two guys who are working on it, reached out. They're from Croatia. They like have this no budget, but they're all doing things in miniatures, in camera.
They're doing actual miniature work, and it looks freaking fantastic. And, I'm overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, they totally get the vibe right, and it really feels like a love letter to the film. Their short film is called Slice of Life, and they have a trailer out if you just want to watch that or back their Kickstarter.
Absolutely. We are avid fans of their work. We should cover them on Tested at some point.
They've reached out.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like a good plan.
There's no chance of any legal trouble, is there?
Certainly.
Okay. Yeah, there's
almost
definitely.
Certainly. Yeah. These are the days of controlling your brand without any holds barred.
I think that's it.
What's on the site this week, Norm?
On the site this week, there's a couple things, unboxings and things that we're going to be showing from the cave that we're shooting actually today.
Mm-hmm.
We have pending in an approval for an edit. Video from our visit to CERN is going to go up this week.
Very exciting.
For our premium members, we are building a model kit this week, a papercraft model kit from a Studio Ghibli film. So you can check that out. Also,
so exciting.
Yeah.
Beautiful work.
And I think people in San Francisco, there's a screening of The Incredibles that we might be at the Alamo Drafthouse. They're doing a screening.
When is that? Saturday?
Thursday. Just go to the Alamo Drafthouse in Mission and you can find out more details about that.
That's a rare opportunity to see The Incredibles in the theater again.
And, you know, as John Landis once said to me, it has the best James Bond soundtrack of any James Bond movie. Michael Giacchino, friend of Tested, Michael Giacchino did the score for The Incredibles, and it's incredible.
yeah. It was right after he did Alias, which is like, you know, spy show. But I think that's the one that people took notice and their ears perked up and said, who is this composer?
Love Jeremy Williams, thank you for joining us on the podcast for your second time.
Thanks for asking me. Thank you.
All right. We'll see you guys next time.
Bye, guys.